Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
There's very little more pressurizing in the world of Formula One than delivering the final Q3 lap in Monaco.
It's sustainment. Hopefully this gives him the momentum that we need to have a proper fight for the championship.
It's a different Lando Norris that's turned up in Monaco.
Lando will join the legendary winners of this race. Lando Norris wins the Monaco Grand Prix.
Monaco, baby! Yeah, baby!
Charles Leclerc, he knows these roads inside out.
How much of it's Leclerc and how much of it's the car?
This Grand Prix matters so much to him that he's prepared to go out there and take risk.
Isaac Agyal, though, is the best of the 6 rookies. I think we've seen enough to be able to say that about him this year. Would you agree?
He's been able to overcome the most embarrassing way to start a career in F1, you know.
I saw the Liam that we had last year back. He had his mojo back and he had a perfect Monaco.
What an eventful and entertaining race that was. Welcome everyone to the Monte Carlo Harbour for F1 Nation's review of the Monaco Grand Prix. I'm Tom Clarkson and joining me in the paddock is 2-time Le Mans podium finisher and F1 TV analyst Alex Brundle and Fox Sports Mexico presenter Diego Mejia. Guys, very warm welcome to the show. Can I ask both of you, first of all, what is the headline from that race for each of you?
Headline of the race is we got a Monaco where the leaders had to push to win. And that I think is the main change, especially from last year, but from previous years as well. You know, we had Piastri crossed up sideways heading towards the wall at Zandvoort at one point because he had to deliver laps. You had, you know, line astern between Norris and Charles Leclerc at the end of the race. So, positive headline for me is it was nice to see drivers push to try to win the Monte Carlo Grand Prix.
On the overall context, Lando bounces back. It's sustainment, one in qualifying, which was crucial for him to win the race. Hopefully this pushes him and gives him the momentum that we need to have a proper fight for the championship.
Look, given the issues he's had on a Saturday this year, how significant is this, particularly what he did on Saturday?
Yeah, massively significant. I mean, he's almost a role reversal between he and Oscar Piastri, you know. Piastri's had such a difficult weekend, couple of bumps. Oh, I mean, it's still a decent finish in the Grand Prix, right? But in comparison to being peerless. But Norris has just delivered and delivered. And there's very little more pressurizing in the world of motorsport and the world of Formula One than delivering the final Q3 lap in Monaco, and he delivered it, you know, what one of the biggest gaps of the year, if not the biggest gap of the year for pole position. He delivered it in style. He's looked at ease. There have been none of the big, long quotes of him explaining his performance, discussing how everything's going to be and all of that kind of thing. It's just been doing the talking on the racetrack on both qualifying day and race day. So I totally agree. It's a different Lando Norris that's turned up in Monaco.
It felt make or break. I think if Oscar had done what he's done at previous races, got qualifying in the bag and won the race, extended his lead in the World Championship, I think that would have been hard for Lando to come back. But now the direct opposite is the case, just basically what you've been saying, Alex. I mean, do you agree with the idea that this is a different Lando Norris this weekend?
I think we have seen him. I'm in the pen during the weekend, so I kind of get a vibe or a feel for what the driver says, how he is. And you can feel that at some races, even those which I didn't attend, Duke, but I still watched the interviews, and you could feel that he didn't arrive at the track in a positive mood. this weekend he was positive from the very Thursday interviews, and I think that he sensed that this was an opportunity to bounce back, and he did exactly that. For a moment I thought, oh well, first corner, both tires blocked, but he managed. You could, on the slow motion, you could see some little rotation, so maybe it wasn't a full flat spot, and it wasn't that bad in the end. And yeah, I think he did a perfect race, leaving that aside. And I think he also said that this was his most meaningful pole. I asked him on the panel, and he said, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember Russia 2021, but that was different. This sort of felt probably for him reassuring.
I thought McLaren stole a march on everybody by doing two laps at the end of Q3 as well. It seems so obvious afterwards, and I was very surprised that no one else did.
When you look at it though, what they've done there is given up a little bit of total car performance to give Lando and Oscar a look at the racetrack. So it's always then easy to say, well, the drivers made the difference. But I do think you're right. They've given them the opportunity to build and then go. And even when you've had three practice sessions, we know the track here just climbs and climbs and climbs and climbs and climbs till the end of qualifying. I do, though, having watched the laps, seen the data and looked into it, think it was a particularly exceptional performance by Lando, because there are areas of the racetrack where the Ferrari is a little bit better. For example, from Mirabeau down to Portier, the Ferrari had been better all weekend. It just rotated better. Lando found a way in those corners and still managed to take the benefits of the McLaren under traction, for example, out of Raskas and out of the last corner. A bit of both, I think.
With your racing driver head on, do you think Lando deserves the sort of plaudits for that lap that so many people were giving Max Verstappen after the Suzuka pole, for example?
Well, it's the fastest lap ever of the Monte Carlo circuit, so he's only beaten everyone else. I don't know, it seems pretty good to me. How long have we been racing here? But, the others did, perhaps in the 80s, they didn't have quite the equipment. But, yeah, it was impressive that.
So if Lando was hooked up all weekend, Oscar struggled. I felt he was never completely at one with the car. He said, actually, after Q3, that finally he had the car where he wanted it. But it had been a battle, hadn't it? All the way through practice, even through Q1 and Q2, I felt.
Yeah, and as Alex explains, here in Monaco is a lot about the rhythm and getting into that rhythm and whatever, because I think he brushed the wall a few times, even in practice, and for sure...
More times than in the rest of his career, actually, was the quote he gave us.
So that maybe, dents his confidence just enough to give Lando the edge, Also, the fact that Lando was able to do this for a racing driver like Alex, doing an 019.9 and being the only one under the 110s, is that extra boost, It's not, he could have been on pole by 1/1000th of a second, but he was the only one in the 109. And whenever, as a racing driver, I've been myself at a lower level, whenever you do a 0.9, it's okay, I managed to break a barrier.
You're walking around the paddock a little bit taller, aren't you? When you're the only guy in your second, it's the thing. But the cars are all in a different zone here. It's why Ferrari are more competitive here. Because it's so bumpy, you need to ride the curbs, you're in a different ride height zone. And I wonder, both between the cars, but also within the teams, whether, for example, we know Lando hates a car or struggles with a car that's front limited. In general, at a street circuit, you set the car up with a lot of front. I would always say it's better to glance the wall than it is to nose the wall at a street circuit. Glance the wall, you might be able to carry on. So I think maybe the McLaren, in an engineering context as well, a little bit more in Norris's zone here this weekend could be a factor too.
Can we investigate the idea of rhythm a little bit more? Something Diego just touched on there. Are we talking about the sort of flow state where you get that sort of, it all just becomes sort of second nature and you're not having to think about it? Is that what we mean by rhythm? And is it easier to get into that state at a street circuit like this because it's so intense? The walls are so close.
There's just a certain muscle memory to it all. And you can kind of, you can read the development of the racetrack and the development of the race car So lap on lap, way better than you can read it when you take a break and then come back. You know, it's exactly like reading a book, really. You know, if you start at chapter 3, having left it for a month, you have to remind yourself who all the characters are, you know, who's whose fiance and so on and so forth, and before you enjoy it. Whereas when you've seen it, you know, moments before, the lap before, it just becomes so much easier to imagine the next 5 meters in the braking zone, the next development, the next thing. And so that's a little bit, I think, what McLaren did in qualifying. You know, it's kind of easier to see things in comparison to a reference point than it is to just sit in the pit lane and try and imagine the ultimate lap and then just go and do it.
So we're now 1/3 of the way through the World Championship. Exactly. There are just 3 points separating the two McLaren guys. Max Verstappen is 25 points behind Piastri now. Is this becoming a two-horse race? What are we? When you look at the performances we've seen, both this weekend, very slow track, Imola last weekend, faster track, are we now more convinced that it's a two-horse race between the two McLarens?
Maybe, but with the wrecks changing in Barcelona, we still have to see. I think Barcelona should suit Red Bull regardless of the regulation change. And if it plays into their hands like they have been sort of making us believe, it could well be that it is still a three-horse race. I would like Max to be in it. But if not, we'd like to see this papaya turn into red mist at some point between the McLaren drivers. I think at some point we're going to see them come to blows on the track. It's going to happen. I think the team knows it. And hopefully Lando's able to build on this for the second third of the championship.
This was Oscar Piastri's 7th consecutive podium this year, his 34th consecutive points finish in Formula One. He is Mr. Consistent. And when you're talking about championships, you know, that's how you win a championship, isn't it?
And Barcelona is going to be telling. One thing about this place is you cannot read anything into this racetrack. When you look at the data plots and everything that comes out, Monaco is like a dot sort of somewhere near the margin, right? And then you've got Monza like over the other side. So with regards to the rest of the season, it's just nonsense, this place, from an engineering standpoint. So the regulation change coming in Barcelona, they've given the teams these first 8 races to figure it out and make a plan for it. The regulation change is a tighten up around the flexibility of the front wing. So they're reducing the tolerances of the amount the front wing is allowed to flex. The reason why teams are flexing the front wing is because Formula One cars of the current era tend to have a little bit of understeer at slow speed, but their aerodynamic profile means that they have a bit of oversteer at high speed. So you allow the front wing to flex away, ditch a little bit of its downforce, and that gives you the best of both worlds.
So a little bit more oversteer in Barcelona.
So a little bit more understeer at the highest speed, and a little bit more, and therefore you can run more front wing generally, and you get a bit more front end at low speed. But, you know, that's going to be interesting. And between the two McLarens is going to be interesting as well. I think Max will be back in it, and I think Piastri will be back exactly where he was in Imola by the time they get to Barcelona.
There was a very nice quote from Andrea Stella on the car presentation on Friday. He was speaking about how maybe we jumped to conclusions about McLaren was quick here, then they should be quick here. In terms of the circuits, and he was saying, okay, some circuits are like apples and others are like pears. So you need to compare apples to apples and not apples with pears. Apples were the kind of circuits where they have been able to build a big gap. The pears would be like the Imolas with fast corners where the Red Bull comes into the picture. And a colleague, I don't remember who it was, but he had, so Monaco is what? He said, it's a peach.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Let's talk about Ferrari then. It's an outlier, Monaco. Charles Leclerc in particular was on the money all weekend. How surprised were you guys?
I was surprised, yeah. Especially because Charles was saying we're not going to be there at all. Last race in the pen, he said maybe the driver can make the difference, and because it's so specific, maybe the car, if we make it good only for the slow corners, it can be competitive. Because we don't need to make it quick for any other type of corners, because it's mainly about the slow speed here. So maybe, but maybe he was lowering expectations,
I guess. Over-deliver. Yeah, exactly.
I really hope he was lowering expectations, because you'd like to think they would know, right? You know, in terms of understanding what you have underneath you, you'd like to think that they would know. Okay, maybe they're not going to tell us everything, but you'd like to think they had it under control. I, until FP3, thought they were just kidding themselves with engine mode. I mean, they were 5 kilometers per hour. I mean, it's not the most power sensitive circuit, but when you go 5 kilometers per hour quicker up Beau Rivage and then 5 kilometers through the tunnel, it adds up to the difference that he was ahead. And it's only when they dropped on the track in FP3 and everybody else was also delivering the top speeds and the Ferrari was still fast, I was like, okay, right, cool. So I'm kind of tentatively believing this now. But yeah, it was impressive this weekend.
How much difference can the driver make? You know, Charles Leclerc, he knows these roads inside out.
I think
how much of it's Leclerc and how much of it's the car?
I think he does make a difference, 100%. I mean, you could see, and it's true what Alex says about the engine modes, but still you could visually see that he was very, very confident. We get to see in Monaco when I'm in the pit lane. Now, from last year, they make us not be in the pit lane, but be in the place where you can watch the second section of the swimming pool and driving into Rascas. And you could see he was, every lap he was there. Even he started FP1, he had enough under braking, I guess, for Sandoval or Mirabeau. So he was pushing. I mean, he knows these streets very well. It's his track. I mean, he's had 3 poles in the last 4 years or something. So it is definitely a circuit where he has put not the best car on pole previously. So I guess there's a lot of Leclerc in the chance they had to actually score their first win, which is second place. And it's the best result for Ferrari in a Grand Prix this year. So
you like to try and be kind of objective in evaluating performance. But and sometimes you just see a driver where it just matters more to them. And like it, you get that sense here with Charles, like this Grand Prix matters so much to him that he's just prepared to go out there and take risk, you know? And around this place, there are so many areas, like the way into Massenet, the way through to back, where if you go out there and go, right, I am going to be fastest at my home Grand Prix, and I don't care if this thing ends up in the wall, somehow it works, right? And I think that's a factor, definitely, along with knowing, loving, focusing on the circuit from an extremely young age. But he's always been electric. I mean, even in Formula 2, he was electric here, Charles Leclerc.
He's always been brilliant at street circuits, actually. It's almost like he sort of love rubbing up against the walls? I don't know, but there's something about him. And it almost got derailed. Do you remember right at the start of the weekend, coming into the Fairmont hairpin, and there was a bit of confusion with Lance Stroll, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, he managed to salvage that. And Hamilton did actually go well. He got his best qualifying of the year so far. Okay, on the road, P4, then got the penalty after impeding Max Verstappen. So he starts P7. But even Hamilton is starting to get a tune out of this car around here.
They could have really used Lewis without that penalty today, by the way. I mean, with the way the race played out at the front, with McLaren being able to force a stop from Leclerc whenever they needed to, and then you know, being able to react with Norris. If they had Hamilton in the fight and he started where he would have started without that penalty, you can then move that a stage back and you've got sort of two versus two. But Hamilton's penalty, and actually, like, the race pace was okay from Lewis. I think he was caught up in a little bit of traffic and stages of the race, but it still wasn't great. Like, he wasn't in a position to sort of light the blue touch paper and turn up, you know, on someone's gearbox. So, yeah, I mean, they could have used Hamilton a little bit more in the fight, but I do agree with you. Like, around here, he has been a bit more in the hunt. Just, he's gone with the Ferrari performance. It's not a case of Leclerc's just taken off into the distance. You know, the gap is not a Verstappen-Tsunoda gap, for example.
Because I felt where Hamilton has struggled so much this year, I feel, is in qualifying. We've talked about the Leclerc factor here, and yet Hamilton was still clinging onto his coattails, which makes me think he really did make a step in quali. And then, of course, is the race a race? And we'll get into all of that a little bit later. But I think they're definitely encouraging signs for Lewis.
Yes. I mean, we looked right at the beginning of the year into the data, and it was the difference was in the faster corners. We'd have to have a look at the data now again to see how that's evolved between Hamilton and Leclerc. But you know, it's interesting that Lewis has felt more at home here. He wasn't enjoying the race too much, though. I sensed, you know,
no.
from the
enjoyed
radio
any of
messages.
The races this year. Maybe yeah. Apart from the China sprint,
there was some frustration going on over the radio. But that's a factor of Monaco too. I mean, I heard a stat today that lap 55, post lap 55 in the Grand Prix here, the accident rate like goes up drastically, because that's the point at which the drivers become frustrated and just think, I'm just going to send it down the outside of the chicane. I don't care anymore. You know, and you can actually plot it and see that.
I'd like to look at my race chart. What lap did George Russell just go, I'm going straight onto the chicane?
Yeah. About that.
Was it about lap 55, wasn't it?
It was about that.
So what of Red Bull Racing? I remember Max saying on the Sunday night of Imola, he was on a high, obviously, after a tremendous race there, that he started to believe that they may be able to do something here. And funnily enough, for the first time this year, he didn't get it all right in qualifying.
Yeah, he was talking about a limitation with the car that is back, that has been there in the previous car. And that, yeah, he put a ceiling, apparently, to what he was able to do in qualifying. So that here in Monaco just limits what you can do in the race. Probably the stat that Alex mentioned was very high on the list in Hannes Schmitz and the Hera Strategy team at Red Bull, hoping to, you know, go to the end and maybe have that red flag that would have given him the victory. But it was all they could do on Sunday to try to get something better than P4.
Yeah, they had to do something different today. I mean, to see Max Verstappen half a second off the pace in qualifying, look back through the data, and it's the slow corner apexes. The car just wasn't there. You know, I saw some data after FP2, but not much later in the weekend, but I'm assuming the trend maintained, where he's losing 0.3 seconds between just Mirabeau and Portier on each one of those apexes with the car not rotating. So didn't quite have the speed. They put themselves in a decent position and were, you know, dreaming strategically of a red flag, which, let's face it, it's not outlandish to suggest. A third of the races here have had a red flag in them, so they did the best they could without, of course, Yuki in the action to help too much. But it's just an outlier event for Red Bull, where the car didn't have the speed and they had to do something weird on strategy that didn't pay off.
Let's talk about the sister team now, Racing Bulls. I mean, what an amazing race for this team. Before I ask you guys for your opinions, let's call Alan Permain, their sporting director, over and get his thoughts. Alan, what a tremendous weekend for you guys.
We always do, you know, pre-race strategy predictions, plots. They rarely come out exactly as you expect. And in Monaco, they never come out exactly as you expect. I think the one today, if you looked at it before the race and after the race, they almost overlay each other. So real kudos to the strategy guys, the drivers. Liam did an immense job to allow that to happen. But the hard work was done yesterday, qualifying where we did, allowed us to do to do what we did today. It was great.
We'd kind of clocked that you were, you know, that teams were going to try and manage pace like that, and obviously give the free stop to the driver ahead. But what surprised me about your strategy was how well Lawson actually came out of it all, taking advantage of what Williams were doing behind you. Yeah, that was a clever bit, wasn't it? Really,
exactly that. And it was a tough one for Liam, honestly. And qualifying ninth, I think he qualified. To then say to him, this is what we want you to do, he was completely fine with it, executed it perfectly, and then of course Carlos did the same, and that allowed, you know, Carlos did it for Alex, and that just allowed Liam to do exactly the same as Isaac had done. So yeah, it worked well.
Isaac is just getting better and better. That seems to be the case. But what about Liam? He's had such an up and down season. How important is this result for him?
Hugely. More than the result. I think Friday and Saturday were great. I don't want to say a turning point, but I saw the Liam that we had last year back. You know, he's definitely had his head down a little bit. I know we've been saying he's fine and we've been building him up and that, but he had his mojo back and the car was working well. He was putting it together. He had, you know, up until, well, even all the way through qualifying, he had a perfect Monaco. He went quicker every lap. He built himself up. He didn't make any mistakes. Isaac, on the other hand, had a very turbulent Friday. He crashed twice. He lost his confidence at one point. He was really struggling. End of FP2, he had one set of tyres. He damaged his first set in FP2 almost straight away, first lap. So he had a set of softs to do the rest of the session on. And at one point you could see he'd lost his confidence. He said, I don't understand the car. I don't know what's going on. And he stayed out and he just plugged away at it and finished up with a very decent lap. I think we finished fifth and sixth or fifth and eighth or something on Friday. And I felt at the time those times had flattered us, you know, that we'd run a little later than other people. We'd probably run longer on the tyres, so we're running a little bit less fuel than other people, and I felt that to get inside the top 10 would be a mega result. And then even again on Saturday morning, Liam was very happy with his car Saturday morning. Isaac not quite so much, and we made a lot of changes, but much more than we'd normally do before qualifying, and he put it together.
Finally, can we just get an engineer's perspective on the mandatory two stops? Everyone's got an opinion on it.
He's a man who loves it, yeah. Presumably.
I actually made it more difficult for us. One would have been easier. We did it because of the Monaco, really, we had last year, which is a red flag, I think, lap one, and then everyone just driving to the end. I think it worked to an extent today, didn't it? There was a bit going on. There was certainly a close battle at the front from what I saw. For me, Monaco is Saturday. That's the exciting bit. It's Sunday is just stress and it's not. I agree. It sometimes cannot be that exciting. Saturday, the spectacle of Saturday is brilliant. It hasn't really had time to sink in. I don't think it hurt us or helped us. I don't really think it made much difference to our race, sort of midfield race. If it sparked the front a little bit, then great. Why not?
Alan, very well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Isaac Hadjar, P6, Liam Lawson, P8. I mean, strategically, what they wanted to happen.
They absolutely nailed it, didn't they? They from behind the wheel and on the pit wall, best qualifying performance of the year for Hadjar, and to get through the Monaco weekend as a rookie driver, qualifying in the top six, keeping the car out of trouble, recovering from being the first car in the wall in free practice, which he was, and getting your head back straight is really impressive. Really, really impressive from him.
Yeah, he has been, I think, in 50% of the Q3s this year, which is amazing for a guy that didn't have as much preparation as other rookies for his maiden season in F1. Liam Lawson should be somewhat happy about his first points of the year. And he was absolutely key to get, you know, to split the race in half, basically. He split the race in half and ruined the race for the second group of guys. But he did what he was asked to. He did it perfectly. It's not a given that you can't be overtaken at Monaco. And he managed to just keep everyone behind and make not only his teammates' strategy work, but also his, which was the same. They just ran a few laps of the medium, of the soft in the middle, and then head to the other lap, to the other tire to finish the race. So, I think it's great to see that both had such a great weekend. reading a little bit of the reaction from Lee, and he's not happy, obviously, because even if it's the first time he's been in the points, he's being outrun by a guy who has less experience than him. And that, at Red Bull, can never be a good thing.
Isaac Hadjar, though, is the best of the six rookies. I think we've seen enough to be able to say that about him this year. Would you agree?
Yes, I think so. Close run thing with Antonelli, although I think Antonelli started the year really strongly. Mercedes have had a bit of a difficult time this weekend. It's not been so strong sort of as we've moved into the mid-year. But yeah, I mean, Hadjar, definitely in the Red Bull system with everybody in their place. Sort of, obviously, Max Verstappen didn't have the best weekend this weekend, but was just Max the rest of the year. Of all of the rest of them, Hadjar stands out, doesn't he? Of all of the rest of the drivers who've driven a car with, you know, Red Bull connection, Hadjar stands out.
Five of the eight races now, he's been the lead Red Bull driver behind Max. And I just want to investigate the job he's done relative to the other rookies now. I mean, you talk about Antonelli, but I think it's the consistency that we've seen from Isaac that has been so impressive, whereas Antonelli has been a little bit up and down. I think he's got a huge future in front of him. He's clearly hugely talented, but taking the eight races we've had so far, I think you have to say that Hadjar's had the best of it.
I think what's impressive about Hadjar is his ability to overcome these kind of like great challenges of the sport, like Monaco, the events you imagine going in as a rookie would just be incredibly intimidating, right? Yeah, okay, you've driven a Formula 2 car around Monaco, but now we're going to go 15 seconds quicker or so. It's extreme, that challenge. And how he and the other rookies, in fairness, they're so well prepared with simulators and so on and so forth. But he specifically, Jeddah was another one, he specifically just takes on these big challenges and delivers the qualifying laps. It is impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he has surprised me. I wasn't expecting him to be so strong at this stage of the year. When you listen to him, you get the feel that he's very confident, and he's been able to, you know, overcome what was possibly the most embarrassing way to start a career in F1, you know, spin on the formation lap for the season start in Australia. We all saw those emotional moments, but he's bounced back amazingly from that.
He's always been very emotional on the radio. So prior to his Formula One debut, I wondered whether he'd be fluctuate in his performances. So his consistency has surprised me.
So he told me back in Saudi Arabia that the radio messages that he always used to give, he still says in his helmet, he just doesn't press the button. which I thought was great. So he's obviously still going on in that. Yeah, there were some days in a Formula 2 car, and he'd have like for example, the final round of the year, just had a really messy round, kind of for what seemed like no reason. There were some days in a Formula 2 car where he's just peerless, like unbelievably quick. You know, he'd do doubles over weekends, like drive through the top 10 in the sprint race, go and take the victory in the feature race despite a bad pit stop the next day, and be, you know, 5-6 tenths quicker than the rest of the field by the end of the race. But he seems to have, car relative, he seems to have found that kind of performance more often in a Formula One car, obviously with the level stepping up to being against, you know, some of the best in the world, and therefore, you know, fitting in rather than standing out. But yeah, he just seems to have found the delivery and maturity a little bit. I mean, maybe he's not quite delivering all of the radio message. I'm sure some of them would have bled through. Would have heard from Alan, wouldn't we? If he'd been giving it all.
Alex, and the resilience though, the way he came back from that disappointment in Melbourne, the way he recovered from the mishaps he had here in practice, he's able to just turn the page, go out and do it again.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Yeah, really, really hard. And it's something that Oscar Piastri's brilliant at. You know, he just goes, yeah, that wasn't very good. Anyway, cool. Are we going to put some front wing in it? That's acceptable. But Hadjar, it's interesting with Hadjar's emotional in the moment. And it's almost like he sort of expels it. You know, kind of deals with it there and then, and then puts it behind him.
Yeah, I was a little bit afraid that he would be another Yuki on the radio.
But even Yuki is, you know, I've not, maybe, I don't know, maybe have I been listening hard enough? I've not heard Yuki go fireworks on the radio for a little while.
You're right, but maybe he hasn't been pressing the button.
Maybe he hasn't been pressing. Maybe the Red Bull radio button just doesn't work.
I've been told that there's an agreement now that he can just expel it off, but once, and it's finished, and you carry on.
Now, what about Mercedes? Neither driver in the points. We're all armchair strategists. What did you guys make of their strategy?
Honestly, there was nothing they could do. For me, there was nothing they could do. You know, you have the incident with Antonelli. You have the failure with George Russell. I think I've got that the right way around, haven't I?
Yep.
Yeah, in qualifying. You know, you go and start 14th and 15th in the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. And you've got two sets of teammates in front of you with a set of rules that effectively incentivize drivers to back off, generate a pit stop gap, take the pit stop and so on. What are you going to do? You can't make an overtake. There's nothing you can do. So, you know, a frustrating day for the Mercedes guys, but would you have made a different call on the pit wall? I don't see any other route.
No, there was nothing I think they could do. I think the plan for them was to do something similar, but they got trapped in another stint strategy because, once Lawson started backing everyone up, they were trapped. So, for George, I guess it was quite frustrating because he thought that they had the best tire allocation in that group because they were able to keep two hards for the race, but that didn't make any difference.
I think when you go into a race that has a mandatory two stop and it's new territory for everyone, I was very surprised that they did the same thing with both drivers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're in Monaco. You roll the dice. I love the fact that four drivers came in at the end of lap one.
I think, yeah, totally. And that those were just the outliers to get those pit stops done, yeah, and play the game. I think, from a Mercedes standpoint, they were in a grid position where they had the option, really. Do we play both drivers independently and run one short and run one long? Or do we try and play the team game? I think that you can gamble on nothing occurring, not having, for example, a safety car or a crash that takes several drivers out of the race up the road. Or you can gamble basically on there being a bit of attrition at the front and being able to maintain those positions. And that's the gamble that they made. So if they put themselves, you know, three or four places up the road, they might have had a go potentially at points with that strategy.
I guess the only thing you can say more is that George actually pitted three times and one was because of his decision to get a 5-second penalty, which translated into a drive through and deservedly, I guess. I asked him in the pen and he said, yeah, I thought maybe something more was coming, maybe 10 seconds, but maybe not a full drive through. And but even then he said, had I stayed behind the Williams, I would have finished lower. So even with a drive-through, it was better to do that. I wanted to enjoy the race. I wanted to enjoy Monaco, and this wasn't.
We should have done it 20 laps earlier.
but by the way, the lap one pit stop worked for absolutely nobody. Nobody gained.
But getting stuck behind a slow Liam Lawson didn't work for anybody either, right?
No. Which is why we're all sitting here going, Mercedes were just, there was literally no strategic option. And when Toto Wolff, you know, at the end of the race goes, we lost it on Saturday, that's what he's talking about.
More to come from Monaco in a moment, but I just wanted to let you know about F1's other official podcasts that you can check out this week. Mercedes Deputy Technical Director Simone Resta is my guest on F1 Beyond the Grid this week. The former Ferrari designer talks about the challenges of managing two development programs this year, both 2025 and 2026. And he reflects on what has been a remarkable career for him so far. That's available from Wednesday. And the latest episode of F1 Explains is all about the magic of Monaco, featuring the great Mika Häkkinen. That's out now. Just search for F1 Beyond the Grid and F1 Explains on your podcast app. Let's now talk about the two stop then. Diego, we'll start with you.
I think it gave us more to talk about. it gave a bit of a different dynamic. It made the race more tense because we just didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, had there been a red flag in the end, Max would have won the thing. So I think it added something. Did it make suddenly Monaco the best race of the year? No. We weren't expecting that. We weren't expecting more overtaking. We were expecting maybe a different dynamic, maybe an opportunity that wouldn't be there with a one stop. I think it was a more entertaining race than last year's. You had more things to look at, like you were all the time watching the gaps, who may have a stop under virtual safety car or safety car. What happens if a red flag, who's done the two stops? Like at one point, the graphics from F1 showed the three different backs, no stops, two stops, one stop. So it was quite diverse.
Something had to happen after last year's Grand Prix, didn't it? That's the thrust. I think the exact layout of the cars, their pace, where they started, didn't flatter the regulation set because you had two McLarens to bully Leclerc. You had Hamilton out of the loop. You had Verstappen without the pace and without the tyre allocation because he only had a soft tyre to go on at the end of the Grand Prix, which is why he couldn't follow everybody else in the final flurry of pit stops. So that kind of locked you in to a sequence of events that, you know, somebody who's watched a few Grand Prix could see play out in relatively sort of, you know, beginner mode chess moves. But plaudits to the organisers for trying something and having the bravery to change the fundamental regulations of the Monaco Grand Prix, one of the most historic motorsport competitions in the world, to try to generate a spectacle. You can but applaud that.
Yeah, I'd like to think that this maybe unlocks going further with this and maybe trying something more extreme for the future.
Well, this idea came from a SAC meeting, the Sporting Advisory Committee. Last winter, four options were put on the table and the teams voted for this, for the mandatory two stop. So there are other options out there that were put on the table. I don't want to see them change the racetrack because that risks taking away the challenge. Anything that risks taking away the challenge on a Saturday to improve Sunday, don't, because this is all about car against racetrack. It's like golf. This is a player against the golf course. You're not actually against the other drivers at this racetrack.
I would sit here and watch those 20 cars pound round line astern for 78 laps. I think it's just amazing to watch.
But it was a field of two halves. At the front, they were pushing hard.
Yeah.
And then middle back, they were in a queue. And so I felt there was way more interest in this race than there has been at any recent Monaco Grand Prix, actually. I thought it was a big step forward in terms of the entertainment that people crave.
Yeah. I mean, us on the commentary, we had more to talk about and more to be, you know, looking at in terms of what could develop if this or that happened.
Guys, there's another thing too, in that I think the intra-team rivalries are going to bubble over as a result of teammates being asked to help their teammates. And this is a nice segue into talking about Williams, where we saw Alex Albon and Carlos Sainz working very well together on the track, but afterwards they were both pretty outspoken about having to do it. And I think it would have been an awkward debrief after the race. And Carlos Sainz in particular, who, you know, has been shown the way home by Alex Albon so far this year, it would have really hurt him to have to help him. I think he just wants a clean race to show him who's fastest and wasn't able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, motorsport is inherently strategic and political, right? It's a political sport, and that is brought to the fore here because, you know, who assists who and why. You know, when you look at some of the intrigue around other sports, for example, cycling, the whole stage is about that. But yeah, I mean, they operated interestingly, Williams. They tried their actual management of pace was slightly messier because people had kind of cottoned on by then. And you had Lawson jumping into their gap. You had Ocon trying to jump into their gap. You had, you know, all sorts of people then trying to, all the lone rangers who found themselves out front thought, I'll have a bit of that gap, please. Which is, I think is why they ended up having to reverse the cars. But you've got to expect that rule set will always generate that result. So that's what you've got to expect.
Alex is doing a great job. I mean, Carlos had always been in Q3 here in Monaco. So you were kind of counting he would be in Q3, and he wasn't for the first time here at Monaco, and Alex was. So that's something. The two races before this, I think Carlos was the faster driver. Circumstances didn't help him translate that into the kind of result he could have in the race. But I think he's starting to get there, and he still has to get there to maximize his learning and getting the most out of his car, his team, and all the package.
Yeah, that does take time. And actually a great result for Williams coming home, P9 and P10. There's one other car that we haven't talked about in the top 10. The sort of stealth mobile, in a way, Esteban Ocon, has his best result in the Principality. He was on the podium here a few years back. He is a Monaco specialist, almost in the way that Charles Leclerc is.
It's a great result for Haas. Feel for Ollie Bearman. You know, I entirely understand the penalty, and they have to be draconian about red flags. So it was red flags in free practice, wasn't it? He passed another car under a red flag. And, you know, as soon as the red flag is thrown, in theory, you can have marshals the wrong side of the barrier. So totally understand it. You feel for him. You wonder what he could have achieved as well. They've obviously got that Haas in a nice zone. They talk about it being like a benign car and an easy car to approach, even if it doesn't have the outright pace. But yeah, Ocon did the job in qualifying. And another driver who kind of ran quite long from the start and then just waited for his opportunity. They knew everyone was going to be playing team games around them. And Laura Müller and the team on the pit wall just went, we're going to slot him in there. And pick their moment beautifully. So that was a great result for them.
Another Lone Ranger.
Another Lone Ranger.
On the topic of any other business, which is kind of how we like to end the show, has anything struck you this weekend that you'd like to talk about? Is there one performance? I mean, I'll start. Adrian Newey back in the paddock. In green, I really sensed Aston Martin. The guys in the garage really appreciated having Adrian on site, not back in the factory.
When you look at what is the downside of that Aston Martin, they talk about the slow speed rotation of it all the time. And you look at the performance of Alonso this weekend, particularly in qualifying. He qualified seventh and then started sixth because of Hamilton's penalty. That's outstanding, isn't it? That's outstanding from Fernando. Really good performance. The one I would pick out, though, Alpine were nowhere this weekend. Really weird. They took a gamble on the medium tyre in Q1, and it really didn't work out for them. Gasly with the braking problem in the race. But after being really strong, I thought, back in Imola, they really struggled this weekend with limited explanations as to why, really.
They're a team that really needs a new team principal. The team actually told me that Flavio Briatore, was the one deciding the tyre strategy for qualifying. Flav has many qualities, but I'm not sure tyre strategy is one of them. And it just makes me feel that they are a team in transition and they really, really need a new team principal. I know that Flavio has spoken to some of what I call his old guard, people who have worked with him before, about coming back into Enstone in that role. He's yet to choose someone. You can't have Flav choosing the tyre strategy. You need a team principal who can stand up to Flav and say, Flav, deal with Luca Di Meo, bring in the money, I'll run the racing team. Actually, do you know who I think would have been absolutely perfect for the team principal role at Enstone? Jonathan Wheatley. He knows the team inside out. He was there for years. He knows Flavio. He's won world championships with Flavio. He would have been able to deal with him. But of course, he's now pulling up trees for Audi and doing a great job at Sauber. So he's not available. But they do need a team principal, I feel. Well, the cranes are going up around us as they start dismantling this place. I think probably, guys, we should head out. Look, final one then. Driver of the day. Charles Leclerc won it on the telly. Do you disagree? Do you agree? Who's your driver of the day, Alex?
My driver of the day is Liam Lawson for doing the job for the team and then secondarily managing somehow to do the job for himself as well with the assistance of the pit wall. But even still, you've got to be able to drive it back into contention, then do your own stops. And that was impressive. I like that.
Yeah, that's a good choice, but I'll go with Lando. I'll go with Lando as driver of the day. Actually, the driver of the weekend. There's a, for those who speak Italian, and you know this colleague of ours, Giorgio Terruzzi. He has a podcast with Pino Allievi, his colleague from Gazzetta dello Sport. It's in Italian, obviously. And a few races back, he said he was putting money on Lando because Lando was more human. And you could relate to his struggles and the fact that he's being able to live the ghosts of the past of being on pole and not getting first to the first corner. I mean, we saw a little bit of that in the first few meters of the race, but he got it done and he got the victory. And that's what counts in the end. So him being able to come back in many aspects, we know a little bit, not the full picture about the whole, all the struggles that he's been going through for the past few races. And him being able to come back, it's only good news, I think, for the championship.
Yeah, I agree. Lando Norris for me as well. A mention in dispatches for Isaac Hadjar, who has had an amazing weekend. But the context of what Lando has done this weekend is so vital. The, what came immediately before and all the qualifying mishaps to deliver, as he did, at the hardest qualifying track of the year, proved that he's back in business. He's just 3 points behind Oscar Piastri, and we've got a fantastic world championship coming our way for the rest of the season. So guys, thank you very much for your time. Alex, great to have you on the show again. Thank you so much for your time.
Always good to see.
And Diego, great to have you back on the show as well.
Thank you very much, Tom, and look forward to see you in the last Spanish Grand Prix in Barcelona, because it's going to be Madrid next year.
It's going to be a good one.
For more reaction and analysis from Monaco, go to F1.com or the official F1 app. And you can watch the race highlights on the official F1 YouTube channel. Now, you can also book your tickets to the F1 movie, which comes out at the end of June. Go to F1themovie.com for more. And let me tell you this, I was at the special screening of the film on Wednesday night here in Monaco, and it's sensational. Well worth seeing. That's it from us in Monaco. Thank you very much for listening. We will, of course, be back on Thursday with our preview of the Spanish Grand Prix. But for now, F1 Nation is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios.